Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
From KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of stories and personal documentaries, and on this episode, we're going to listen to a story that we broadcast not too long ago, actually, but we're going to hear it again for a few reasons. For one thing, The Atlantic magazine chose it as one of the best podcast episodes of the year last year, plus it's a story by legendary radio artist and storyteller Joe Frank. And a Joe Frank episode almost requires repeat listening. But unfortunately, we heard last week that Joe has had recent medical problems that sent him to the hospital last month as part of a series of health issues he's dealt with for most of his life. But now it's gotten to the point where his medical bills are piling up far beyond anything he can cover. It's a fact that Joe Frank is a crucial figure in the history of radio storytelling. His DNA is in this show or almost any story or documentary podcast that you might listen to. I don't usually do this, but I want to mention a GoFundMe page raising money for the Joe Frank Medical and Recovery Fund. It's at GoFundMe.com/Joe Frank. And while you're doing that, we can all listen to this program produced by Joe and his collaborators. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional and Downfall. By Joe Frank.
Some native peoples, they would have a name like Soar Like an Eagle. That's the person's name. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to lose their human nature and take on the nature of an eagle to soar. And it's been a failure. It's never worked out.
Because people can't soar like an eagle.
They can't soar like an
eagle. Is that
your point? You know, right. That's exactly the point. And you're walking around with your chest puffed up, you know, and they go, oh, soar like an eagle. So, you know, and this guy gets pneumonia or whatever, you know, he's out there coughing on the Great Plains and wrapped in a blanket and gets a fever and he sweats and suffers and dies. Old soar like an eagle.
This bestowing of names like soar like an eagle or...
Iron Fist.
Let me introduce you to Iron Fist. Hello, how are you, Mr. Soar Like an Eagle? Thing is, does anybody in these situations pick an animal that is not admirable?
Spotted mouse.
A lion meets spotted mouse, and the two of them have a conversation by the fire?
Right. Brave lion and spotted mouse.
Soaring eagle.
And soaring eagle. And crushed ant. Smoking tent meets burning treehouse. Mildew sleeping bag meets rotting poncho. Hat stench. Oh, hail hat stench. Yes, short pants. You know?
In this episode of Travels Across America, we're visiting Sandhill, a town in Georgia that's received considerable national attention due to a lethal combination of human failure and natural catastrophe, which has led to a recall election challenging the leadership of the mayor, Solomon Hicks, who has been blamed for virtually everything that has gone wrong here in Sandhill. And in the midst of all this chaos, Mr. Hicks has been kind enough to discuss the problems facing him and his town. What they're complaining about is the crumbling infrastructure of the town with its potholes and craters that make driving very unsettling. And then last week there was the collapse of the Westward Bridge during rush hour, killing 140 people, many of whom were swept away in the rapids below and drowned or were smashed against the rocks. And then shortly after that, there was the cave-in of the elementary school auditorium roof, during the eighth grader's production of Death of a Salesman, which wiped out the entire class, as well as their six teachers.
And they were scheduled to, after that, do a production of Molière's Tartuffe.
It's not a matter of what theater productions these children were going to mount. This money that was not spent on infrastructure, the bridge, the roof of the school, has gone to service other interests. Where did this money go?
Well, it went to numerous places of import. We had a birthday party for a statue.
Let's move on to another subject. For 3 months now, you've been unable to come to a resolution of the garbage strike, which has caused just an enormous pileup of trash on the streets and in the alleys and the public parks, resulting in an infestation of rats and bubonic plague that has spread throughout the city. How are you dealing with this disease? And don't you think you should have resolved this strike by now?
Well, if ifs and buts were candies and nuts, Mr. Franks, we'd all be fat on the sugar quality of that hypothetical. Now, would I like the garbage strike to be over? Of course I would. It's not that easy. There are garbage strikes all over the world, Mr. Franks. Some get resolved in an hour, some get resolved in about 3.5 months.
The problem with this one is it has caused terrible catastrophe to the town, and if you do not address this problem, it will only get worse. More people will get sick.
Which is why we're doing everything we can in our power to open the world's biggest amusement park.
Now, what does that have to do with the problems that you're facing?
Well, one, it takes people's minds off of the pile of trash that is accumulating, although we have found work for the indigenous community here, going through the trash and finding recyclables and whatnot. So we are mindful of the environment. And we had some arts people in to take what they call refuse and to make art projects out of them.
I'm told that Lake Minnewaska was once a beautiful crystalline blue lake where families would go to picnic and swim and sunbathe and relax. But now this lake has been polluted, resulting in the deformation and death of fish. You can see them floating on the surface of the water. We were over there just a little while ago. And there were other land animals who come down to the water's edge to drink and end up as carcasses. And so now the lake is off limits for swimming. And recently it's come out that you sit on the board of directors of ChemWorks, the chemical company that has been dumping toxic waste into that water. How do you explain that?
Quite easily. ChemWorks is always giving back to the community. And we made a solid contribution to the fencing around the lake, to the signage, to the locks, to the security people who stand guard to make sure nobody gets sick or hurt. That is one of the ways ChemWorks is giving back.
When I got home, I decided to take a long, relaxing bath. As I lay in the water, I became aware of the steady drip of the faucet, but I was too tired to lean forward and turn it off. The steam in the bathroom thickened. I could hear a conversation down the street, everyone speaking very slowly, and the sound of the water droplets were long and drawn out, like slow-motion explosions. It was like a dream, but I couldn't come out of it, and I started to panic. I was afraid everything would slow down to a point where I wouldn't be able to distinguish one thing from another, that all sound would melt and blend. I tried to break the spell by banging the side of the tub with my fists and my feet, but I couldn't move. Then I fell asleep and dreamt I was riding on a rickety hay wagon drawn by an old horse. I was playing chess with a man whose face was hidden beneath the dark cowl of his robe. Suddenly, a wheel came off the wagon, and a coffin fell out, spilling clocks ticking without hands. And I watched legions of professionally maimed and disfigured beggars follow tourists to their hotels and wait underneath their cars. I was lying on my back, a ceiling fan slowly revolving above me, and there was a woman lying beside me. When I reached out to touch her, she shrank back. Then she walked barefoot out onto the balcony overlooking the city at night, and holding a glass of brandy, turned the snifter in her hand. And then she suddenly tore at her gown, smeared ashes on her forehead, and cried out, "Where is God? Indeed, where is he? Or she? Or it?" We just watched a report on television of a plane that had gone down in the South China Sea. 239 passengers had been killed. I'd imagined them sitting in their seats, watching the in-flight movie, or working on their laptops, or thinking about where they were going or what they'd do when they got there. The future laid out before them when, boom, they're all dead. At the airport, we watched their grieving relatives interviewed on television. "How do you feel about the death of your daughter, her charred body floating under the sea?" A letter was found in the wreckage. It was addressed to me. "Dearest Joe, I received your package today in Barcelona. It was a wonderful surprise after waiting so long in Tangier. I arrived exhausted after a hectic plane trip. Hilda and Paco were there to greet me, and Paco challenged me to a game of chess. Instead, I watched the two of them play, and it was most relaxing. The trip has given me a good chance to be objective, and I've come to a decision. I think it would be best if we never saw each other again. I expect to leave for Macau on Tuesday. It will be a good change, a wonderful contrast. In every way." I remember what it was like when we were young. The sweetness of her breath, the softness of her hair, the music of her laughter, the clarity of her eyes, and the eager yearning with which she introduced herself to life's great mysteries. Her spirit enlivened me, gave me hope. She believed what I told her. She was deeply affected by my words. Her love had no limits. We moved in together. A few weeks later, I came home and found that she and every stick of furniture were gone. The bed, the television, the dishwasher, the oven, the refrigerator, the wall-to-wall carpets, the toilets, the bathtub, the boiler in the basement and the steam radiators, the molding from the walls, and all the doorknobs and electrical switches, leaving only dangling bare wires. Apparently, she'd had a huge tractor trailer rolled up to our house, and with a crew of movers, had swiftly taken everything. Even the windows had been removed from their frames. You can sing the blues on the midnight special to Memphis, but you can't sing the blues on the 542 to Westport, overturned and burning in a ravine. You can sing the blues on a lonesome highway, but you can't sing the blues getting a brain tumor from your cell phone. You can sing the blues on a porch in the rain, but you can't sing the blues drinking tainted kosher wine at a doomed Passover service. You can sing the blues down on the dock of a bay, but you can't sing the blues having accidentally inhaled a seafood dumpling in a Chinese restaurant. You can sing the blues at a card game, but you can't sing the blues being struck by an errant golf ball at the Riviera Country Club.
Here's an interesting fact about one of the Amazonian tribes, you know, who basically have nothing and live off the wilderness there in the rainforests and jungles of the Amazon. And, and they've been doing it for, you know, millennia, just for thousands of years, living the same way.
They're living on the grubs and the small animals and...
And these particular kinds of trees that grow, they cut them down, and then they scoop out the inside of the tree, and they pound it into and it's this white pulp, and they bake it, and it's kind of like a bread kind of meal. And they, you know, they roll over these logs, and they have whatever they are, those larvae, you know, and they collect those, and those are delicacies at all kinds of bugs and crickets and things like that.
And the rich people come, people who, you know, have luxurious homes back in the civilized
Silicon
world,
Valley.
Enjoying all these advantages in life, they are often less happy or unhappier or not as happy or just not they don't enjoy their lives are unfulfilling. And what right do they have to be going to psychologists and taking antidepressants and sitting at home with their heads in their hands, grieving over the misery of their lives? It just seems so absurd.
After years of depression, I began seeing a therapist twice a week. I told her about the loss of my job and years of loneliness. As time passed, our relationship evolved into a friendship, and she began to reveal the difficulties of her own life, to confide her deepest secrets. And eventually, our sessions were more about her problems than about mine. But I was so lonely that I continued to look forward to our meetings. And then, one day, she told me about the most traumatic event of her life, which she remembered vividly, an experience that had irreparably damaged her. Her father was a wealthy man, and she grew up in a fine, comfortable home. Her 7th birthday was being celebrated at a party in the dining room. It was a high-spirited affair, attended by family members and her girlfriends in second grade. A hush came over the room as she blew out the candles. Then everyone applauded, and her father rose to propose a toast. He held up his glass and was about to speak when he turned ashen, grasped his left shoulder, overturned his glass, and spilled wine all over her birthday dress before collapsing on the floor. He lay there, spasmodically convulsing, until he died. Her dress was stained. The party was ruined. She ran up to her room crying and locked the door behind her. Her father had done it on purpose. It was her first, but not her last, experience with an unreliable man. The next morning, she called me and abruptly broke off the therapy, citing the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. She said it would be inappropriate for us to continue therapy and assured me it wasn't my fault, that I shouldn't blame myself.
Find myself talking to an imaginary friend, you know. It's a self-comforting tool, you know, a way to validate myself, to reassure myself, you know, that I have...
That you're not alone.
That I'm not alone. That I have someone there to converse with and to share ideas with and maybe even contradict me. And I imagine what they're saying back to me, and then I'll agree with them. I'll say, yes, of course, you're right, and I was completely off base on that. And I notice people looking at me as I'm having this conversation. I think they recognize that I'm just talking to myself.
The other day I was driving along and I began to count the number of single people walking alone in the street as opposed to people with other people. And I found that more people who were alone were talking on cell phones. And at first I assumed that they were simply lonely and needed someone to talk to, so they had placed a call to a relative or a friend. But then it occurred to me that these people were trying to impress the rest of us, including me in my car driving by, that they had some important business to transact as I turned the corner and ran over somebody else because I was watching the person with the cell phone. There's a scandal involving your relationship with your opponent, Mark Swift's wife. Do you think that affair should be taken into consideration in determining whether or not you're fit to be mayor?
I hope it would be. I'm a man who has given comfort and guidance to a woman whose needs were not met by a man who was, I don't want to say physically abusive, but I just said it. But take it back. But don't edit it out. But do put it in there with the context of me saying, I don't want to say it. But I did say it. So there it is. It's out in the open. Although I spiritually take it back. But don't take it back. But again, in the context of, I wish it wouldn't have to be said. But it was said. I wish it wasn't me, but it was. So take that with a grain of salt and move on.
What about considering Mark Swift himself? The man has been cuckolded, humiliated in the town. That's probably one of the reasons that he is running against you.
Now, don't forget, he brought this upon himself.
Well, how did your affair even happen?
Well, I ran into her, okay? We were in the waiting area of the restrooms at the country club, and I ran into her, and she seemed to be crying. So I attended to her. And when you see a woman crying, whether you know her, whether she is a stranger to you, you give them a little neck massage, and you make them feel good about themselves.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I don't think every man who sees a woman crying immediately gives her a neck massage.
Well, maybe that's the problem with America.
As a result of this relationship that you had with Mr. Swift's wife, you have been the object of a campaign of attack ads paid for by Mark Swift.
Smears, I call them, Mr. Frank.
Well, I tend to agree with you. They have been very ugly, and they seem to air every 3 or 4 minutes on television. You can't get away from them. And it must be difficult to see yourself repeatedly painted in such a loathsome light. Which of these ads do you find most annoying?
The one in particular that's animated, and he has me morph into a rodeo clown who's in a toilet bowl laughing and playing. I didn't like that one. I don't appreciate the one that's a picture of me, and then the camera pushes into my eyeballs, and then in the center of my eyeballs, the eyeballs replace with film of the Holocaust. I had nothing to do with that. Zero.
I'm looking for a small screw-top plastic container. I believe I left it on my desk, next to my notebooks, beside a cup of coffee and a Danish. But I may have left it in the Fairmont Hotel's bathroom, because Dr. Nierenberg, at the food table, as I was eating some kasha with kiwi fruit salad and pickled Vidalia onions, said he required a urine sample immediately, and I was directed to follow the wrought iron fence facing the small gazebo at the end of the gravel path. In the men's room, a tall young man, half my age, stepped up to the urinal next to me. He unzipped his fly, and I heard a thundering, steady splash, like a horse relieving itself. And I looked down at my own thin, pitiful stream, while the young man zipped up and walked over to a row of sinks. He washed his hands, dried them off on a paper towel, and left. It took another 30 seconds for me to squeeze out the last little dribble. After I washed my hands, I found the dispenser empty. He'd taken the last towel. I dried my hands and my hair and looked at myself in the fluorescent lit mirror, the harsh light draining the color from my face. In one cubicle, I could hear a man wrestling with his trousers, and there was a child blowing his nose on the tile floor, and a young man wearing a leather jacket and boots standing between the trash bin and the condom dispenser. When I was 5, my father gave me 2 silver dollars. I went out into the front yard to play with them. I dug a hole, put them into it, covered them with dirt, and dug them up. I made believe they were buried treasure. A woman approached up the block. She asked me what I was doing. I told her I just found 2 silver dollars buried under the ground. The woman said they belonged to her. She snatched them away and walked off. I was confused. I'd been so absorbed in my fantasy that I didn't know what to believe. An ambulance passed. I heard the distant wail of an old woman. It began to rain.
Mr. Franks, I pray every day of my life. I pray for you. I pray for me. I pray for my family. I pray for loved ones. I pray for people who don't pray.
Well, to whom do you pray?
I pray to God, Mr. Frank. I pray to God. Well, who do you pray to?
That's my business.
You've been listening to Downfall, an episode produced by Joe Frank, with Ryan Catrona, David Cross, and Joe Frank. It was mixed by Ray Guarna. Special thanks to Michael Story. And once again, the address of the site that's raising money for the Joe Frank Medical and Recovery Fund, gofundme.com/joefrank. And you can find that link, plus other information, at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The associate producer is Nick White. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Unfictional or like us on Facebook. And I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.com.